Hello and welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I'm your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I'm honored to be joined by Mr. Joe Bergamini, who's a drummer, educator, author, clinician, consultant. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Bart, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to catch your recent clinic and your discussion at the drum set committee at the most recent PASIC, which I just loved. I thought that was so cool. It was mainly about teaching in this crazy modern era of video. It was really important stuff. I loved it.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I've been going to PASIC, the Percussive Arts Society International Convention, for many, many years. And actually kind of relates to our discussion today. I built a lot of different elements of my career by attending NAMM and PASIC, you know, just as a civilian, you know, so to speak. Sure. Kind of egged on by Dom Famularo, who was my teacher. And those first, just going to learn, going to all these clinics, going to see performances, and then as I got more involved in the industry, starting to do presentations. So that panel, actually, I got involved with the drum set committee, and my thought was, so many people who go to PASIC are, you know, we're in the trenches, so to speak, working, teaching, especially teaching, and it's like for us, that's a professional development conference.
Absolutely.
Right. So I was like, let's make the drum set committee panel, you know, something that actionable stuff that other peers, you know, guys and girls can take home and put right to work. So it was Eric Hughes has been the drum set committee chair for a long time. And he's done such a great job. So he welcomed that. And then so that led to me thinking about maybe I should do a clinic about teaching. I've seen so many great clinics. I mean, you go from all these amazing players playing things that are just in the stratosphere. I mean, you're going to see the most, you know, so my thing wasn't about that, you know, I mean, but yeah.
But it was refreshing to see that. It was like a different take on, I don't know. It was tools for your tool belt, you know, it was actual, things that everyone can leave. Not that you wouldn't go home and practice drum stuff if you're watching, you know, an amazing drummer, but this was like, practical tools.
Well, you'll go home from there wanting to practice for sure, but I think in terms of like what's offered, they do a great job of offering all different things, and you know it's important to offer those different things because I'm here to tell you there's guys who can play way better independence polyrhythms than I can play, faster chops than I can play, and you know that's great, but it's only one thing when it comes to making a living playing the drums. It's only one. And and actually you can make a living playing the drums without doing any of that stuff if you have other things in order.
Sure. Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, it's and that's the beauty of PASIC, and I recommend everyone out there to go and check it out. I'm lucky because it's only about 2 hours from me. It was awesome. But we have a couple housekeeping things to talk about first, but I just want to let people know today's topic. Joe has some really cool books that we're going to be talking about. Stuart Copeland, Drumming in the Police and Beyond, and Neil Peart, Taking Center Stage, A Lifetime of Live Performance. Okay, so the housekeeping stuff. I want to first give a big shout out, Mr. John DeChristopher, who has recently been on the podcast as a guest. Is just like, it's unbelievable. He joined up on Patreon pretty much right after at a level that is pretty substantial where he gets the tier is he gets a shout out. And I just love that because John is someone who I really enjoy his Live From My Drum Room series. I think it's just like important knowledge to be passing on to people. So this is, you know, it's funny because it's the shout out, but it's not just, you know, some guy or girl. It's John DeChristopher. I mean, it's someone who really is, as you heard on his episode a couple weeks back, he's just such a veteran of the industry, and I know you know him. What's your experience?
I want to say, Johnny D, thank you. My brother, you know, it's funny. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Sabian guy, you know, endorsed 30 years, endorsing the company and now consulting for them. And of course, John, as the worldwide artist relations director for Zildjian, we got to know each other in the biz, and it was a classic example of just sort of becoming like seeing each other in the hallways at places. And I'm like, you know, John was like, oh, like I've seen this guy a few times. Oh, his name's Joe, you know, waving in the hallway. And then, like, you know, I'm so happy with Sabian. He was at Zildjian. It was the great example of just, I didn't want anything from him. And we just became buddies. And the thing I, you know, not only is he a gentleman and a scholar, but you know, looking at what he's done since he left being the artist relations director from Zildjian, he just loves music and the drums, man. Yes. And he's not only a great guy, but I'm in awe of his passion for it, and was pleased to, you know, he's really good friends with Rob Wallace, who owns Hudson Music. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of podcasts and been on his interview thing when we did the Jeff Porcaro biography, which I helped to edit.
Sure.
So Johnny D's one of the good guys, man. Love you, brother.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just, you know, so Live From My Drum Room is what people should check out on YouTube and the podcast form, which is kind of the audio version of it, obviously. Just thank you to John for joining up and helping to support the show. Very, very cool. And then the second thing, which this is going to be a surprise to you, Joe, so I guarantee you don't remember it, but I emailed you in 2013 with I would call it now, reading back, just an asinine, rambling email about how I wanted to have a book and a video series with you through Hudson Music, where I had absolutely I was just out of college. I was working as a drum teacher, and I was doing these videos in this old warehouse that I have as like a music space, just silly stuff. And you answered, you had a very nice, I don't think we can do this at this point, but thank you for reaching out. You were very, very nice.
Oh, really?
And I just wanted to say thank you for that. Cause again, it's just like basically a kid at that point coming at you with, why would I get a book at that point? Why would I work with the biggest distributor? But I just think it's kind of funny, cause now, I guess I started the podcast 6 or 7 years after that, which I think has been my thing, and I'm fortunate it's been pretty successful. Just to keep working at it, I guess, is the takeaway for me of, like, you know, you were very nice, and I appreciate that.
Well, you're welcome. It's funny because I'm the kind of guy who, you know, I've been teaching a long time, and I want everyone to succeed. You know, I want to see all my students and my peers succeed. And I love nothing better when I get a proposal from someone and we put something out through Hudson Music or Wisdom, my little company I have with mm-hmm. Dom. But you know, the hard part is you can't say yes to everybody.
Yeah.
And the hard part is that, you know, this business can be mean, you know, like you don't get where you want to go without, you know, like me working with Hudson Music is not, you know, I didn't find an interview link on LinkedIn and get the job. It's the result of, you know, a lifetime of me working my tail off.
Yeah.
Just because I loved it with no guarantee of success. So, you know, it's a fine line with your younger self coming to Hudson Music with your idea. It's okay to do that.
Sure.
It's just how you do it. And if someone comes at you like in a super entitled way that, you know, hey man, I have the greatest thing in the world and why wouldn't you want to do it? You know, I can be, you know, I try never to be dismissive or certainly, you know, I remember the first time I went to the NAMM show and I'm walking around and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm like, you know, I'm like a tiny pimple on the body of the music business. Like I'm nobody, I'm nothing. Like I don't even want to walk into the Vic Firth booth and Vic's there with Omar Hakim but eventually, you know, I think if you come from a place of respect and you want to, so yeah, I get proposals all the time and I do try to, you know, we Rob Wallace and I, we do look, you know, we do look at them, you know, we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You were great though. And I appreciate it. And it's just funny to look back too, cause I've heard Rob Cook, you know, the great author and the Chicago Drum Show, he's mentioned on some of his episodes, like when people send in proposals to play a clinic at the Chicago show, he's talked about, you never want to be mean to people because you never know what they're going to do. And I mean, in no way am I this massive person, but I'm happy that I looked back on that and went, okay, I was trying to get my foot in the door that many, almost a decade ago. And you were so nice that it didn't like shut me down, but it, you know, I look back and I'm like, okay, that's cool. I'm glad I kept going and kept trying different stuff until one thing clicked and kind of has become my thing. So again, it's you're a nice guy.
You're very welcome. And I think the lesson is, if you can't handle an occasional no, not getting the gig and a little disappointment, don't get into the music business.
That's exactly right. Yep. You nailed it. Okay. So now moving on to the topic here. So you have written these two great books, about one about Stuart Copeland, one about Neil Peart. And I'll let you start with whatever one you want. But I think just first off, maybe Neil or Stu or whoever, just how the heck did you get in the door and how did you start this process of writing these books with these legends?
Well, that's a great question. And as I look back, you know, the whole, this whole process of getting to be like sort of the drum book guy or whatever is, it's really sort of an organic thing that, grew out of my, I think what I, my personality, like I have a certain, when I was first starting to play the drums, Neil and Stuart were two of my favorite drummers. And, I'm that kind of like organized OCD person that I like to go in and dig deep. And Neil's body of work really lends itself to that. The lyrics and the, his setup, you could just tell the intention of everything, you know. People will say, well, you know, he plays the same fills all the time. I mean, how could you? He so much thought went into playing what he played. So, you know, is it better? Is it worse because he plays the same fills? That's ridiculous. It's totally, no, you know, so sure. I, you know, just the care and the nerdiness of his whole thing came
attention to detail. Yeah. And yeah.
So I, you know, I literally poured over everything I could get my hands on about him. You know, I played along to Rush for 2 hours every day in seventh, eighth, and ninth grade. I found a guitar player that he liked Rush. And in my school, Rush was like considered really nerdy. So like nobody else really liked them. I liked all the other bands, you know, Sabbath and Metallica and the Chili Peppers and Van Halen, but they would, you know, they would sort of make fun of me for liking Rush, partially because they knew it like made me angry when they did that, you know? And it just made me all the fiercer of a fan, you know?
Sure.
And then I went and got, there was an early book called Drum Techniques of Rush. People are trying to hawk it for like $500 on eBay right now. It's a joke, but,
wow.
I subscribed to Modern Drummer because, you know, Neil was in Modern Drummer all the time. And I just loved trying to find out about him. And I'm like, oh wait, here's a VHS tape, Exit Stage Left. Oh, you can see his drum set in this little, you know, we didn't have, I know this always sounds so like, you know, oh, back in the day, I walked uphill, you know, two ways to school. But like, there was something cool about not being able to have full access. Like,
yeah.
I had to pause the video, you know, to see like, oh, in Xanadu, oh, he's playing the tom there. I thought he was playing a timbali. I mean, it was the you know, freeze framing things, wearing out the VHS, and then, you know, waiting for a transcription to come in Modern Drummer.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it on the show before. That era, that way of learning really always does add to the mythical nature of artists, where you have to like catch a little glimpse of them, and you have to pause, and you have to wear out your VHS tape because you watch it so many times. It adds to their, you know, godlike status, really.
Right. So I think nowadays the mystique part is very much diminished, you know, like, but the thing that's not diminished, and the thing that's, I think the point of this is, I did a mega deep dive into these guys that I loved their work for no other reason than I was just totally fascinated by it. And then that eventually led to me, I used to love reading along with that old transcription book, and I was taking a few lessons, but really reading along with that book made me a better reader. And then I got fascinated with how things looked, and I was like, well, great. I mean, if they publish one in a magazine, I want to be able to use it. So I credit that with actually improving my reading. And then of course the next step was like, you know, they don't have the Hemispheres Prelude transcribed in this book.
Yep.
I'm going to transcribe it. And so then I went, and just because I wanted to, I would go and learn how to transcribe first on paper, and then eventually with a computer program. At that time, you know, it was the early days of Finale and things like that. And all of these skills I sort of like developed over you know, the months and the years, and just because I felt like they were things that I might, you know, that might help me in my career, but moreover, in the beginning, I just enjoyed doing them.
Yeah, and, which I mean, God, the passion you have for something really dictates how much time and effort you want to put into it.
Exactly.
Of course. I mean, yeah.
So, you know, I'm kind of coming around the long way to answering the question, but,
sure.
Basically what wound up happening was I eventually started submitting some of those transcriptions to Modern Drummer magazine. And I got published in Modern Drummer as doing some articles from time to time.
Wow.
And really enjoyed that process. And then I was studying with Dom Famularo at the time, and Dom asked me to help him with his book, It's Your Move, which at the time was still unpublished. And so between those kind of things, I worked my way into getting a few things published. And I found it very empowering, not only because I got to see my name in the magazine that I was reading since I was a little kid, and I was just honored to be a part of it, but I just was like, wow, this is great. Maybe this is another little income stream, and I really like doing it. And that eventually led to me getting into the world of publishing drum books.
Yeah.
And so what fascinated me about drum books, so most of the time when I'm working with someone from Hudson Music, you know, they have a method book or a book about a topic of some kind. And that's kind of like what I teach, that's the basis of my curriculum, you know, the sure. Afro drum set method book, Gadiments, Future Sounds, The Art of Bop Drumming, Afro-Cuban Rhythm, you know, all those classic books.
Yeah.
But that Drum Techniques of Rush book just stuck in my head. And I just love that it was about Neil. And I was always fascinated with these sort of artist-driven, do a deep dive into the work of one person. And so the first thing that happened was Modern Drummer, after I did the articles for a while, when Bill Miller and Ron Spagnardi were still alive, both mm-hmm. wonderful gentlemen who really, you know, gave me a boost up in the beginning. They asked me to do a book of what they called red meat transcriptions. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to hold up the cover. It was the MD Classic Tracks.
Yeah.
And this is just a transcription book. And Bill and I chose Carter Beaufort, John Bonham, Terry Bozzio, Vinnie Colaiuta, Phil Collins, Stuart Copeland, Neil Peart, Keith Moon, Steve Gadd, Simon Phillips, Jeff Porcaro, Mike Portnoy, Steve Smith.
Literally the best, the top tier drummers in the world.
And we actually said it was the drummers that, for Bill and I, the guys who, you know, we liked in the music that we listened to. If Bill did that book with, you know, Mark Griffiths, I wouldn't have been the guy to do the jazz version. In the jazz version, that would be Tony Williams, Art Blakey, Max Roach,
yeah.
you know, Jeff Watts, all those guys. And if it was sure. the funk version, it would be Zig Boo and David Garibaldi, you know what I'm saying? So not to say the greatest of all time lists to me are just a total joke, you know?
Yes.
But anyway, you know, holding up a page again, I was able to kind of do a little bit of a, you know, write some text, have some photographs. And I was like, this is the kind of thing I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And shortly after that, again, going to these trade shows and networking and meeting people,
yeah.
I met another guy who became a friend. At the time, he was the doing acquisitions for Warner Brothers when they were still doing drum books. Mm-hmm. And this fellow's name was Ray Breisch. I actually just saw him. I had a gig in LA and we reconnected. And there was, at the same time at that Drum Techniques of Rush book back in the day, there was a Drum Techniques of Led Zeppelin, and it was full of mistakes, like tons
of
them. And I had been bugging him, not unlike, you know, you approaching Hudson as a younger version of yourself.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, we should really redo those and make them better. And so finally he said, you know, that's a great idea. And I redid the Drum Techniques of Led Zeppelin book.
Yeah.
And for Warner Brothers. So,
sure.
So that's kind of how I got my foot in the door of doing these kind of personality drum books.
Which is important because, I mean, there's something very, it's a business. You want to sell books. You want to sell stuff. Having John Bonham on the cover of a drum book as you're walking through Guitar Center or Sam Ash or whatever, looking at that, you know, rack of books, I'm going to grab John Bonham. You know what I
right.
mean? So it helps to have that biography level of it. And I like how you include the little blurbs about the drummer and the pictures and the fun stuff like that. So it makes sense that it's a direct, it leads directly into doing the other books you did about Neil Peart and Stuart Copeland, which, why don't you describe those a little bit about what they, like a summary of them for people who may not be, know about them.
Absolutely. So I had actually gone, I just want to mention these others. I became the drum editor for a hot second for Carl Fischer. And when I was there, I wanted to continue doing that. I always wanted to do this thing. So these, you know, I did one with Scott Rockenfield from Queensryche called Operation Rockenfield. And then one with Jason Bittner, called Drumming Out of the Shadows. And so I kept developing the idea so that when the time came and I met the guys from Hudson Music, I kind of brought this idea with me. And what happened was I always wanted to do those kinds of projects. But once I got with Hudson Music, I was almost doing personality projects every day because I came into the company and we were doing a DVD with Keith Carlock and Aaron Spears and John Blackwell, Steve Gadd. So the idea sort of lay dormant, but I thought to myself that I wanted to do it. And I loved the transcriptions, but I loved like the drum set diagrams and the text and the photos. So after I had been with Hudson for a few years now, I knew that we've established that I was a Neil Peart freak and he was my hero. Sure. After a few years of working with Hudson, Rob came to me and he said, I just met with Neil and he might be open to doing a project. Could you write a proposal for him?
Wow.
And after I picked myself up off the floor, because you know, the first 5 years I worked for Hudson or whatever it was, I never brought up his name because I knew enough about him to know that, you know, if he was interested in doing something, it wouldn't be coming from some unknown guy, you know, proposing it. So once Rob said that, I immediately said, I want to make the dream version of that Drum Techniques of Rush book. And I want it to have not only the transcriptions, but I want it to have, you know, photos from every tour, the drum set diagram from every tour, and Neil talking about the parts from all those songs. And, and that's basically what the idea developed into. So these two books, and I hope there's more. I you know, it's fun to do them. It takes a lot out of me to do them. They're sort of like a combination of a scholastic transcription book of a survey of the artist's work combined with a coffee table book of full color photos and biographical information. And my dream was, and actually this, thanks to Neil, this happened. I wanted to make it so that if you didn't read music, you would just buy it anyway, because there was so much other cool stuff in there if you were a fan.
Yeah.
And Rush actually sold the book at the merch stands on their last two tours.
Wow.
So unbelievable.
Let me ask you this. All right. So let's get into actually working on it a little bit. So what was your experience like the first time you met your hero, walking into a room and meeting Neil?
Right. So that could go on a long time. So before I get into that, I'm just going to say that it's an interesting position to be in that I'm really thankful to be in. And in some ways I feel not qualified for, which is when you approach someone, let's say it's fresh in my mind approaching Stuart Copeland. You say, hey, you know, we want to do something about you and we want to do a survey of your career and your work and we want to document in transcriptions. And Stuart, you know, understandably might be like, okay, well, that's an honor. Who the F are you?
Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
And so the first step is they have to like trust that you're the right person to do it.
Yeah.
And, so that was the first step of getting that's the first step in any of these projects. You have to make it clear to the subject of the book that, you know, they should be comfortable with you and you're qualified and you're going to do a good job of documenting them. And now, you know, I have a couple of things under my belt, it's gotten a little easier. But even if I'm working on a biography, so I had the privilege of editing Liberty DeVito's autobiography, similar task in, you know, every time I'm editing with someone who I look up to like that, I'm always like kind of testing the waters, like, gee, you know, if I rewrite that sentence, is he going to get angry at me? You know? It's like, if you're playing on Broadway shows in New York, like you have to come in at a high level every time, you know?
Of course. Yeah.
So it's the same thing. So, and then if you establish that, then they get your trust. Now, so you asked about how it happened with Neil. So the first step with Neil was, because he was so reclusive and was so private, and Rob already had a friendship with him. Rob knew that the first step was, you know, let's get Joe to write a proposal and see if it even catches any interest, you know? So I did that, and I wanted it to be a survey of his work. I knew full well that he didn't want to talk about, you know, his thing back then was he didn't want to talk about any of the old parts. He was just tired of, you know, if one more person asks me, how do you play the drum break in Tom Sawyer? I'm going to punch him in the face. Right. You know,
yeah. Just, yeah. Yeah.
So sure. I knew he didn't want to talk about that. He was never interested in revisiting the past, which, you know, I always found fascinating about Rush. You know, you had all these people who are like, oh yeah, I like the old stuff. I don't like anything after Hemispheres. I don't like anything after Moving Pictures. I don't like anything where they use the keyboard. Well, they must have been doing something right, because they filled arenas
until
their very last, you know, they never became an oldies act. They stayed relevant.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I think if any band is a band long enough, there's always their first album was better, or their last album was better kind of people, where that just comes with the territory, you know, there's
right.
No way around it.
So I put something together, and while I think Neil didn't want to go back and necessarily talk about the old stuff, like he sensed that there was a real love and knowledge of his work, and maybe he would want to try to figure out a way to make it work. And I was pretty amazed by that, because I thought he didn't want to meet any of his fans. And most of the time he didn't, because it was uncomfortable for him a lot of the times when that happened.
Yeah.
You know, I've met some famous people who can't get enough of, you know, they're just give me more adulation, you know, give me more adoration, give me. Yeah. It's a strange thing that happens to you when you're given that level of, you know, you can start to drink your own Kool-Aid quite easily, you know?
Yep.
And Neil struggled against that. So Rob's like, why don't you meet Joe and see if you might be comfortable working with him? Hmm. So Rob brought me to, basically he made my childhood dream come true. He brought me to a Rush concert, and I met Neil backstage on his bus.
There's nothing cooler than that.
I mean, seriously, if my life story with Neil ended that day, you know, I met him on his bus. Rob and Neil caught up for a while, and then he said, let's take Joe out to the stage and show him the drums, because it was sound check time.
Wow.
So I got to walk in, you know, I'm walking in next to, and you know, Neil has like a bubble around him backstage, you know, no one can get near him. He's just private like that. So I'm literally staring at him. I can't believe I'm walking in backstage to a Rush concert next to Neil Peart. And then we get to the drums, and he's like, go ahead, sit down. So, you know, we just started talking drums, talking shop. You know, and I can remember I sat down and I noticed that his seat height was the same as mine, even though he was like a foot taller than me.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, Neil, it's so funny. We have the same seat height, but all the rest of your stuff is too high for me to reach. And he's like, yes, I have a very long torso. I was like, oh my God, he's just like I thought he was going to be.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. Wow. I mean, and you're right about that bubble. I think most people know this, but you would know much better than me, but from what I understand is he's not, I think he fought the perception of being a mean guy, but he wasn't. It was just more of a, he was like shy. It almost came off more to me of like, I don't want to hear about how much you love Tom Sawyer. You know what I mean? It was more just he's not interested in all the fanfare. It wasn't a mean thing, right? Fair to say.
Exactly right. And working with him, it took a little while to get to a thesis of the book that he was comfortable with. You know, I could go on about meeting him all day. I've told the story in other venues. But anyway, he wanted to document his current way. His brainstorm was, I don't want to talk about the old recordings, but if we can talk about the old songs and use the way I play them now, because he felt that his playing had developed, then we can do that. So taking center stage, what it became was a documentation of his touring career with Rush and playing the songs live. And I went through every tour and documented the drum set for every tour. I reused his text from the tour books all in one place, got him to do new interviews about each thing. But the transcriptions were of the Time Machine tour. And it was a perfect tour to do it for, because that was a tour that they went from beginning. They did a retrospective. Played Moving Pictures in its entirety, but so it gave me a chance to go through, and in his case, that's how it was. Now, for Stuart and for anybody else that I would do the book with, you know, I don't think they would have that issue or you know, perspective that Neil had with Stuart. We used the classic studio recordings of the Police.
Gotcha.
So that's what taking center stage was. It was a dream come true. And in the case of Neil, we became friends. And so,
yeah, which that's, I mean, it's, they need to trust you and like you as a person, which I think that's, you should be, which I'm sure you are, very honored to have gotten on the inside and get that respect from one of your idols. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that.
It was, you know, he loved talking shop. You know, it's funny. People think I could ask him Rush questions. He was fine with it. He loved the fact that I loved his work.
Yeah.
You know, and he loved, you know, stories. Like, we would trade drummer stories. When I would tell him about being super nervous subbing on a Broadway show, or, you know, not being able to follow a conductor playing with a symphony, and I didn't, you know, he would laugh and just, he would love it. He couldn't get enough of, you know, and I'd be like, I'm sitting here talking shop with Neil Peart. This is, you know.
Yeah. I mean, he probably enjoys those stories too, about real deal down in the trenches drumming, as opposed to arena drumming in one of the biggest bands in the world. We all still like hearing those stories of, like, not that playing on a Broadway show is like a bar gig, but you know what I mean? It's working drummer every night, hitting the road. He probably loves that. I mean, he likes those stories.
He did love it. And I guess the last thing I'll say before we talk about the Stewart thing a little more is, you know, there are a lot of things that set him apart in my mind from other people I've met. And one of the things was that he had that constant, a lot of my heroes and the guys I looked up to have a constant desire to grow and get better. And as I've known them, they have in crazy ways. To name names, for instance, Steve Smith, David Garibaldi, John Reilly, you know, three of the guys who I look up to the most and have either studied with, or, like, for all intents and purposes, studied with, because I did a book with them and I, you know, they made me do stuff with them that made me get better. Neil did that. And for a guy that was as worshipped as he was, to see, he saw the flaws in his playing and he tried to address them, and he was just trying to get better. And he definitely had a humble outlook on it. Yeah. Whereas, you know, I think most players, and I'm not saying one of these is right and one is wrong. You know, a lot of really big players will be like, okay, so I don't improvise a lot. I must be doing something right. I won the Rock Drummer Poll and Modern Drummer. You know, it's like I pulled the lever and, you know, I won the jackpot every year.
Yeah.
I'm just going to do what I do. I mean, I think most people do that, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and just as an example, you know, Bernard Purdy doesn't care that he can't play prog rock, you know? Why would he care? You know?
No, he does what he does, and that's his thing, and he's made a career of it. So yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah. So anyway, he had that desire to get better. And
I want to say too that obviously I plan on doing a biography episode on Neil Peart, because I think everyone wants to hear that. But I need to find the exact which I'm sure you could probably do it, but like it needs to be an hour and a half devoted just to Neil's childhood and all this stuff. So at some point that will happen on the podcast. This episode is brought to you by Dream Cymbals and their awesome new cymbal bag. It is a heavy-duty, strong, durable cymbal bag made for professionals with a nice tread on the bottom, and it's reinforced everywhere that it needs to be. You have three compartments on it, two in the main pocket area and then one separate compartment on the outside of the bag. It has padded shoulder straps and a nice handle, or you can wear it with a single strap kind of across your body. It fits sizes up to a 24-inch ride, which is really huge. And then you can just walk around having the confidence that your cymbals are safe in this awesome bag from Dream Cymbals. Check it out at dreamcymbals.com or on social media at Dream Cymbals. This episode is brought to you by Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full-line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee. Call 615-383-8343 or go online at ForksDrumCloset.com. So let's talk Stewart. I love Neil Peart. I love Stewart Copeland too, but I growing up, I just loved the Police. I loved that islandy kind of vibe with, you know, the rhythms and all that stuff. And he has such an interesting background with, you know, the way he was raised. So talk about Stewart a little bit and working with him and all that stuff.
So, you know, having Rob at Hudson Music has, you know, we both still have a really deep passion for all these artists and bands that we like. Hudson Music has documented so many amazing drummers. When we think about someone who has the body of work and the interest or you know, detail of their full persona as a drummer, you know, we try to think of, for a book like this, who has that sort of full package of like the vibe and the, and so Stuart was an obvious choice because he's just instantly identifiable. The band was, you know, his body of work was just so well known by everyone and so iconic and so different. You know, he's sort of one of the signature people of his time.
Totally.
And you know, he's like looking back now, it's interesting to look back and see that, you know, the people who maybe you talk to rock drummers and you realize everyone was influenced by him, you know?
Yeah.
Other guy, you know, you're hearing the same thing now about Alex Van Halen, you know? People are like, sure, he's an unsung hero. Well, not anymore. Like every rock drummer friend of mine, we're all like, oh man, Alex, you know,
he's pretty sung. But I do agree though, where Alex Van Halen is a guy though, where maybe he doesn't come up first in your conversation. But Stuart Copeland's interesting because I think he does come up first in your conversation, but he's different from Neil, where Neil, you think of YYZ and this long solo that everyone has watched on YouTube 10 million times. But with Stuart, you think of his interesting rhythms and his interesting sounds and his style and just the look of him and
right,
tall and lanky with short shorts and that big kind of cushion on the side of his snare.
Yeah. Like, I have to say another thing was like, you know, watching MTV and getting glimpses of his drum set. I love the fact that he, like, I was like, oh, look at that. He has only one bass drum, but he has, what are those long tube things sticking out?
Yeah, the octobons.
What,
yeah.
What are those little things? He's got all these tiny little, are those cymbals in the front? What are those tiny little things in the front? You know, it's like our instrument is so, you know, geared to your personality. You know?
Yes.
And I love, it's cool that so many people play a four-piece kit with one ride, the minimal thing. I get it. It's cool. I like a drum set. Like, I love looking, going, you know, being at a drum festival, and like Simon Phillips's kit, you know?
You read my mind. I mean, it's like, it's impressive. And they're all Tama guys, which you're a Tama guy. So, I mean, that has to influence a little bit of that.
Yeah. You know, when it comes to my endorsements, Tama, Sabian especially, but Tama, I mean, thank God they like me. You know, I mean, I really do like them the best. I mean, it's pretty honest, bro. You know, it's
sure.
But anyway,
yep.
So I Stuart was always a favorite drummer of mine. I never analyzed his drumming as deeply, and I knew I was in for a lot of work with this project because there was always something in the, I would try to figure the songs out, and I was like, wait a minute, like, why am I hearing the snare, the hi-hat, and the crash all at the same time? Like something,
yeah,
like, man, this guy's doing some stuff. I don't know what's going on. So I would try to learn it. And then later on certain tunes, like on Synchronicity was oddly enough, was the first record I really dissected from him.
Yeah.
Some of the tunes where like King of Pain or something were wrapped around your finger.
Yep.
You know, I could clearly hear, you know, what was going on, but if I put on Synchronicity 2 and you heard that, you know, that, like, I was like, wait a minute. In passing, you're like, he's playing some hi-hat openings. And then you go back and like, wait a minute. That's a cymbal. He's choking the cymbal. Oh, but the hi-hat's still going. And then
it's like, how is this physically possible? I mean, he really is like an octopus kind of drummer where it's, how is this happening?
Right. So what I discovered, so we started getting into the depths of things. And so in this case of Stuart, there's a process in reaching out to any of these artists that, you know, you want to make sure they have to see your other work. You know, we'll send them a copy of the Neil book and some of the other books that we did. And I'll be honest, I wanted to do this with Alex Van Halen too. Alex, if you're listening, you know, get the Stuart book if you still want to do it, you know, but you approach and usually you get a nice, respectful answer. Sometimes there's no interest, you know? So in the case of Stuart, we actually tried years ago and we tried again. We thought maybe with the pandemic, maybe he's at home and maybe he has time for us to interview him, and it worked out. So, so it was a different experience than meeting Neil. Like once he was into it, we had an initial Zoom meeting with him and I started doing a lot of research. I started going back to make a proposal for him. I went back and listened to all the Police albums and I made a song list. And then I tried to look at some of the other things that he had done and, you know, we always have to send in a proposal, and so he found it enticing. And then we had a Zoom meeting, and then in the Zoom meeting, it was pretty wild because I got to be on Zoom with Stuart Copeland.
Yeah.
I still have the recording saved and can't delete them, It's like the voicemails of my son when he was little, daughter when they were little, and me on Zoom with Stuart,
Children and Stuart. That's the most important thing.
But in the case of Stuart, I was learning things as we went along. And of course the book, and I'll hold it up for those who are listening on the podcast. It was the same sort of thing. Like, I wanted to have historical photos and document his tours. And
it's like you can sit down and just on your couch and read a drum book and look at these amazing photos and see his. And actually, there's something that's something with the internet that you kind of like take advantage or you forget how important it is to not just Google image search Stuart Copeland, but to sit there with a book is pretty cool. And like to zoom in is to bring the book closer to your face.
Right. I actually think you hit the nail on the head. Like I imagine the coolest experience of somebody, going through one of these books is like, oh yeah, cool. Like here's, Ghost in the Machine.
Yeah.
And they put the record on while they're reading this text right here. And they,
absolutely.
And then putting on the recording and listening along is, I think, the main thing I hope people would do. If you want to go down to the shed and play some of it, that's cool too. And so as a result, like just from a teaching perspective, my students, like this isn't the kind of thing where it's like you go through it paid front to back, like a method book. This is something something I wished I had as a kid listening to these guys. Yeah. It's like a combination of a learning tool and going to the Yankee game and buying the yearbook. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. It's just geek out and look at the pictures. And like we said before, these are both drummers that have very impressive, large, unique drum sets. They both have interesting, what's that thing? Oh, I've never seen that. You said those little kind of tiny cymbals with Stuart. It's like, and then I like with Modern Drummer, we all love the diagram of the drums in the corner that has the list of what they're playing. I mean, it's so much more than just, I mean, we love the personality of these drummers and the background. So plus it's just a really well-made book. Just you holding it up, you can see it's a nice book.
Yeah. They're heavy and they feel nice, but you're making me think about, there's a risk with all this too, because you're documenting the artist's work. So I had transcribed every little thing she does is magic by hand. And I started to, so the big thing about Stuart, any big fan of his knows, like he uses digital delay on the recordings. And I didn't realize how much he used it as an instrument in the studio. Hmm. And so as I was interviewing him, I transcribed every little thing she does is magic. And I knew there was a delay. I listened to it enough times to have figured that out. And as part of our proposal, I sent him the transcription. He's like, I want to see, because Stuart, unlike a lot of other of these famous drummers, he composes for symphonies and he does his own charts.
Yeah,
yeah,
for sure.
So he actually sent it back like a college paper. He corrected a couple of things in red and then he graded it. He gave me an A. It's in my permanent.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's in my scrapbook. He's so awesome.
Wow.
But as we worked with him, he's wonderful. He and Neil were such good friends, and they had such different personalities. Like Stuart will get, right up in like, and I told Sting not to do, you get like right up in there. And, but as we were going through and I was learning about his background, a couple things, learning about the delay and then being able to document it, he would explain to me what he did on certain tracks. And then I would have to go back with my transcribing team to reanalyze recordings to try to make sure we were getting it right. So for Walking on the Moon, I said, well, maybe we should just write out what you actually played. And he said, no, that's like, I was hearing the delay and I was playing because I was feeling and knowing what I would create. So I want every note documented.
So you're saying that so what he played, obviously we all know that then the addition of delay would make it sound completely different, through the headphones or actually through the master bus or whatever. He would want you to document the sound with the delay.
Correct. So, and by the way, he set up the delay would be going live. Like his tech, Jeff Seitz, would turn it on.
Oh, cool.
So it's a he would get that back in his monitor. So he wasn't just using it as a studio trick, and he wasn't trying to replicate it by playing live. It was actually being done by. So what we did was, we did it a couple ways in the book. The main way we did it was we have a special note head that's in parentheses that represents a note that was played by the delay.
Okay.
So because they overlap. So the Walking on the Moon chart, I was, you know, actually Mike Sorrentino, my good buddy, great professional drummer from New York. I have other transcribers that I'll get to work with me now because the writing part is so time consuming, and why not share the fun of these with some of my good peers and the guys I really love working with. So Mike and I were like, this thing's going to look like hieroglyphics, Stuart, you know? And he's like, I just want it to be documented. So sit down and watch, you know, just follow it, and you can see all the notes that are there. And then for some of the tunes where he did overdubs, you know, like Message in a Bottle has a ton of overdubs. We actually did two staves, like a grand staff, so that you can see, we're like, let's just make this, if you know, not an amalgamation of what you could do as a drummer. You know, there's other books that do that. Let's actually say what, let's try to document what everything he actually did, like geek out to the nth. So it's like, here's the overdub line and here's the basic line. And he checked all that stuff. You know, of course, his memory is going back 30, 40 years.
That's fascinating, because you listen to some of these albums and you may say like, God, that sounds like an overdub, but you don't know. But now that you're actually doing it, it's so cool to have it documented. Like, oh no, it's an overdub. This is what he's playing. So maybe possibly it's not physically possible to do it all in one go. Whereas, like you're saying, where some books might kind of do like, this is what it would sound like if you smash them together.
Right.
It's really cool. You're like being very pure. You're like, this is what it was, which is awesome.
So Hal Leonard has all those play along books out, and they're really wonderful, and they have sound alike recordings. So if you want a Message in a Bottle chart to play on your gig, that's paired down to a 5-piece set with no overdubs, you can go find that stuff. And then the other thing is, you know, in all these books, there's a lot of front material. Like in Stuart's case, telling his story, being born in America, but brought up in the Middle East, in Lebanon and Cairo, Egypt, really factored into his playing style, and coming out in ways that weren't even conscious to him. Like it was just how he was programmed. And so when I got to the final, almost the final draft of the book, you know, he read through it and he sent me an email back saying, hey man, you know, I think, you know, everyone knows I liked reggae, and he told the story about it a lot, but he's like, you went way overboard on the reggae. You haven't documented my Middle Eastern influences enough, you know? And it was like, oh, okay. I thought I did mention it, but I clearly, you know, so
yeah,
my, the fact that somebody like Stuart Copeland would trust me to, you know, they have to be, you know, comfortable. And then so I had to respond to that, and I was like, oh yeah, I did miss that. And I went back to the interviews and I watched them again. And I rewrote, you know, he felt like there was a couple of tunes where he was like, you mentioned this as a reggae thing, but one was Spirits in the Material World. Right. So when he's playing here, you know what, I hate to do it, but, like that I'm hearing the snare, the bass drum as the backbeat, even though it's double time. And I'm like, you know, again, that sort of like ska reggae thing. And he was like, in that case, you shouldn't say that there. You should listen to the Baladi rhythm from Lebanon, because I think that was actually what was in my head for that. So yeah, it's pretty fascinating. And then I'll hold the book up again. Again, because he was so into his gear, there's a big section on gear, and I wanted to go back and bring that, like the ads from my childhood, like old Paiste and Tama ads from, you know, there's all that research too, in addition to the drum set diagram. So,
which I think, I mean, that's awesome. Yeah. So Joe's holding up a diagram of beautiful diagram of his setup. And just again, versus, you know, let's say book versus internet. What you're doing though is again, putting all of this together, where you can find ads of Stuart Copeland online. But to have them all in one place that you're actually physically holding when you're, you know, not just sitting on your computer is a really important thing. to see his gear and what he was using. And I don't think you need to be a Stuart fanatic to be into this. I think it's, you know, and this is, it seems like a good gift for like a drummer. You know what I mean?
It was actually at Christmas time. I do sell them on my website. I do sign copies. I don't sell, you know, Stuart signed some for Hudson, but yeah. I was really flattered. Like people came on my site and it's joebergamini.com if anyone's interested.
Sure.
And ordered like friends of mine and teachers and people I know, you know, ordered like Christmas gifts for their husband. Joe, can you sign that? You know, so yeah, it is
awesome.
That. And you know what? Like, it's not to say internet research is I did some internet research.
Of course.
Like when I was looking for photos, like people, it's all of the ins and outs that go into actually putting the stuff in print. You know, I went and searched for photos and I was like, oh, there are photos in existence from Montserrat when they were recording Ghost in the Machine. I found them online. Who took those photos? You can't print them in a book unless you get clearance for the photo. So like,
yeah.
I mean, every photo you see required, you know, if I wanted the old Tama ad, you know, that's easy. I know the guys at Tama, like, do you have an archive?
Sure.
They don't have everything in the archive, but they have a bunch of things in the archive. So with photos, just doing the photo research for it, you know, and Stuart sent me to Jeff Seitz, his tech, who, believe it or not, texted me while we were doing this interview. Jeff, he's such a wonderful guy. And so, you know, Jeff went to Sting's tech, Danny Quattrocci, and Danny had those pictures of Stuart in the studio.
Wow.
And so Danny helped us out. So, I wish and hope that I could do. I do have a couple more people in mind. I don't want to jinx us and say who we're approaching, but and like I said, it takes a lot out of me. So I don't know that I could do one of these every 6 months.
Do you consider it like a series? You know what I mean? These types of books, obviously they're not really related, but I feel like if you do more and more of them, then you could have a catalog of these particular kind of artist spotlight transcription books. It's really, you know, they work together.
It's funny. I hope this doesn't come out sounding corny, but like, I feel like I've noticed as I've, you know, I'm in my 50s now. And as I've gotten older, I realized, you know, I have a recorded body of original work. I haven't, you know, the two bands that were really forefront and Happy the Man were these prog bands. Neither one is active anymore. And I still have an output as a player, of course.
Sure.
But I've noticed my teaching practice, my teaching business it's mine. I love it. I feel put a lot into it. My students, I take very seriously when someone invests in studying with me and it's like kind of a thing I built for myself and I really love it.
Yeah.
These books, and this is the part, I hope it doesn't sound like, I feel like it's an album. I made an album. It's like my album.
Absolutely.
You know?
No, I think so too. I mean, it's your, I feel the same way with an episode that took a long time to get booked and we did it and it was great. And now it's out and it's my baby, but it's the same thing where you did so much work on these books and you spent so much time with your heroes and it's such an experience for you that, yeah, you should feel like that. I mean, it's great.
I'll be totally honest. Even with Neil or Stuart, like when I finished and the thing was out, I was like, oh, thank God, I'm not doing that again. You know, and then like, you know,
yeah.
So, you know, 6 months go by and you're like, oh man, I should, and then I'm so lucky. I get, you know, emails from drummers and fans, you know, like, hey man, what's your next thing going to be? The Stuart thing's a masterpiece. Who are you going to do next? And I'm like, oh, I got to do another one. So,
that's awesome.
There's certain people that, I think if you know me, you could probably guess who I would want to do it with, but there's so many. One of the people that I'll say this one, we did Gadamints with Hudson mm-hmm. Music and, the pandemic was a catastrophe for the music business. But I have to say, I don't know if the Stuart book or Gadamints would exist if it weren't for the pandemic. I mean, Steve was at home and he was just practicing and he documented it. And now we have this wonderful book. For me, that was another out of body experience because Rob Wallace and I were on Zoom with Steve and Steve would make me play the stuff. It's like, yeah, man, could you just play? I just want to make sure it feels okay. And I'm like, you want
no
me to-
pressure.
Yeah. I'm like, he's like, could you just play it, man? And I'm like right now.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God. Like, you know, but anyway, we've been talking with Steve about doing this with him, you know, documenting. Can you imagine Asia and 50 Ways and, you know, and Spain, you know, all the stuff he's done, Chick, and it's endless. It's endless.
Yeah.
You know, then he went back on the road and now he doesn't have time, but I'm hoping that someday, you know, we could do a wonderful thing like this with Steve.
Yeah. You feel weird saying that the pandemic made things kind of easier in certain ways or better like that, but it definitely, it ruined a lot of things and made things terrible. But I think you and musicians, a lot of us had to find ways to like make it work. Mm-hmm. And that's a, you know, there's benefits to it, I guess, to having the time to do it.
You know, if you keep yourself moving forward, you know, I started teaching on Zoom and Skype. Well, actually not really Zoom. I will admit I'm sometimes a little slow to move to the next platform.
Sure.
So, but I had been teaching online for several years. And so when the pandemic came, it was just next day, everyone, you're on Zoom, you know, tomorrow, Zoom or Skype. And it worked fine. I mean, I feel horrible for everyone who, you know, I hate that I couldn't play. I was desperate to play, make music with other human beings. But on the other hand, you know, I taught 4 days a week, and I got to tell you, Bart, no one had missed a lesson. All of 2020, no one missed it. No, everyone was just home. They had nothing to
do. You're home.
You know?
Yeah.
So can I have two lessons this week? No.
Yeah. I'm bored, please, for the love of God.
Right.
Yeah. No, and I think that's, you know, the stories of people doing good stuff is great, as opposed to, you know, I mean, everyone lost work, which was terrible. But so on the topic of work here, Joe, I mean, that all is fascinating. And we should say rest in peace to Neil Peart, because, I mean, my God, what a loss. I think that goes without saying that.
If you haven't seen at Hudson, we have a really nice tribute page to him. And I wrote a eulogy, and that's the only place I posted it. But if you haven't seen that page, maybe go there. But I miss him a lot as a friend and as a drummer.
Very beautiful. Yeah. So let's talk about you as we wrap up here. You obviously said joebergamini.com, BERGAMINI, right?
There you go. Nice. Well done.
So you play with the Doo-Wop Project. You've played with a ton of Broadway shows. I mean, you're just the definition of a working drummer who makes it kind of with the books and the industry, and you play. Just talk about you and what you got going on and all that cool stuff.
Some people call it a working drummer. Other people call it a masochist. No. Yeah, I started playing on Broadway shows in 2003 with the show Moving Out, which was still all my brothers were friends to this day. I still do a lot of stuff in this sort of Billy Joel tribute world. And then I joined a progressive rock band called Happy the Man with Dave Rosenthal, who's Billy's musical director now.
Cool.
So Broadway led to a lot of other great things. I continued subbing on many shows, had a lot of great adventures. Including subbing for Tommy Igoe at Lion King, another brother of mine who I love dearly, and Andres Ferrero at In the Heights, and a little bit at Hamilton, not too much. Jersey Boys, Kevin Dow, School of Rock, Gary Seligson, Beautiful for Clint DeGannon. All of these gentlemen are like, I'm honored to try to play as well as they can play. I think I did a good job. I didn't get canned anywhere.
there you go.
Anyway, over the course of doing these shows, you know, you get other gigs, you meet great players. And so I fell into at first subbing and then having the chair with the Doo-Wop Project. It's five singers. They met doing the shows Jersey Boys and Motown. And the musical director, who's become one of my closest buddies and guy I love dearly, is Sonny Palladino. I met Sonny subbing for Clint DeGannon at Jesus Christ Superstar. And then I played with him again, subbing for Jared Schoenig at another amazing drummer at Pippin. And so Sonny and I were buddies. And then I subbed, you know, Clint was the original drummer in the Doo-Wop Project. I subbed on that gig. And then eventually it led to me taking over the chair full time. So I've been with them probably, it's going to be a decade before you know it. I think it's 8 years now I've had the chair. Wow. And before the pandemic, we had worked it up to 100 dates a year. And it's a really fun gig. You know, it's such a far cry from what I got known for in a very small way earlier on, playing odd meters and prog rock. This is all groove. It's traditional doo-wop, 60s and 70s R&B, and some current, you know, more modern material. They sort of like revamped this doo-wop. One of the biggest challenges is we have at this point, we have four different symphony shows that we do. So, I've played with, you know, a dozen of the biggest, you know, I played New Year's Eve with the Baltimore Symphony, the week before Christmas with the Naples Philharmonic in Florida. Still a bit of a nerve wracking experience for me. I didn't go to college for music. I sort of learned it all on the job.
Sure. Wow.
So yeah, so I tour with them, and it's just a wonderful band of brothers now. And I always wanted to be touring in a band. And strangely enough, earlier when I was younger, you know, I was mainly working around New York subbing, and you know, I had my chances to do tours. Never, some of them weren't really up my alley for different reasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, now I'm doing it. And if you told me when I was 20, if you told me that, you know, you'll be in your 40s and you'll be playing in Beijing, standing on the Great Wall with a doo-wop group, I would have said you're freaking crazy. But that's how it's worked out.
That's so cool, man. I mean, you're the real deal. Obviously seeing your clinics at PASIC and stuff, but you're all about the next generation, I think, is fair to say, about teaching and spreading it on to the future generations. And one thing I think too, it's just neat, is I've seen you around a few times and your son is usually with you.
Yeah.
Which I think is super cool. And I didn't get a chance to meet him, but he seems like a nice guy.
Oh, thank you. His name's Nick. And you know, he's always been around the drums. Just I'm so lucky. I mean, I'm a workaholic. I mean, my work ethic would probably kill a lot of people. I have to always be doing something. So what I do, I think, is I don't give up on things easily, and I work really hard, but I love it. I'm having fun. And my son, you know, Nick's been around this his whole life, and he likes, it's so funny. I'm like, Nick, you got to listen to some younger bands, man. He listens to all the same stuff I do, Genesis and Toto and Rush and the Police. And you know, he does listen to younger stuff, but
of course,
it kind of like, I got to say, as he became in high school and he got more and more into drumming, it kind of crept up on me. He's like, yeah, I want to do what you do, Pop, you know? And I was like, oh man, like I never pushed him to, you know, I never said to myself, you know, my boy's going to do what I do, you know?
Yeah.
So the fact that he's gravitated towards it, I just, it's so awesome, you know? And
yeah.
So now we go, you know, he's in college for music. He's playing, he's working his way up. He's doing some other things, you know, in the industry with, you know, me and my other companies to learn those things. And, you know, we went to see Genesis play this farewell tour that they did. And Phil Collins, sadly, is not playing drums anymore.
Yeah.
He sits in a chair at the front, but his son, Nick, is the drummer. And Nick is a beast. He's just so good. He plays so great. And so I'm there with my son, Nick, and Phil, you know, at the Genesis show, when Nick plays the hard stuff and like Firth of Fifth and Behind the Lines, he just turns around. And he just looks at his son, and you can just feel the pride. And I'm there with my son, and it's just like,
that's awesome.
It was the best dad son thing. So when we go to PASIC, you know, it's like you know, all the guys, like Nick is one of the cats now. All my friends, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny because he sat in with the doo-wop project. He did it at one of our gigs. Sonny and the guys are so great. They're like, oh, you can't do the gig. Send Nick, you know? So he sat in, and Sonny had been waiting for like a month to do this. And he's like, you know, they say there's, to the audience, he's like, they say there's these stages of a musician's life, you know, four stages of the drummer's career. Stage one, who's Joe Bergamini? Stage two, get me Joe Bergamini. Stage three, get me a young Joe Bergamini. And stage four, who's Joe Bergamini, right? So he's like, we're in stage three. Here's Joe's son to come out and play.
That's hysterical. Yes.
So
that's so funny. But I mean, you have like a built-in drum buddy now. Nice. I mean, you know what I mean? Like that's, and my son is two, but of course I have a little Ludwig set for him. And like, we have the piano and guitars. And when he sits down, puts his little headphones on and starts playing and just screaming the ABCs, it's like, yeah, you know, he can do whatever he wants. He can be an accountant if he wants. But I'm like, of course, I'm like, yes, play the drums.
Right. Yeah. It's, I think, you know, with teaching with my son, it's magnified, but you know, I've had the honor and responsibility really of teaching many people who they came to me in sixth, seventh, eighth or ninth grade, studied with me all through high school and want to be drummers. And many of them are, you know, I'm proud to say, but, you know, I always feel that it's not easy to do this, you know?
No.
And so I feel it magnified with my son. You know, I think he's going to be okay. I think in a lot of ways it's been on my mind that, some of the things that I did to make my mark that I described in this very interview are not, they don't produce income now. Magazines, you know, writing. Modern Drummer would send me a check for a couple hundred bucks every time I wrote an article. So there's ways, I think, to do it that I don't know, because I'm not the younger generation, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, they have to figure out what those ways are. And I, as a, I'm skeptical of some of the things I hear. Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong about some of them, you know, like, you know, if you post all your videos on the internet, you know, for free, you'll make a lot of money from the ads.
I mean,
there's probably someone listening to this that says, you know, you're a nitwit, you can get rich doing that. Okay. I don't know.
I mean, I'm from being, I don't know, doing a podcast and now trying to get more into YouTube, I can say kind of like, you know, I guess, bluntly or whatever, you can make some money, but it takes a long time. You have to have 1,000 subscribers and you have to have, I think, 10,000 views before you can even make a dollar.
Right.
And then you have to make $100 before they'll even send you a check. I mean, it is not like, oh, I'm going to put up all my videos and then I'm going to quit my job. It's like,
right. Well, no. You know, I guess the point is this, not for me to be an old guy and say what works and doesn't work, but what I guess my version of, you know, going to the NAMM show and going to PASIC and networking and meeting people and trying to figure out different income streams and trying to learn what produces income and trying to drum up work and going out and recruiting students. And all, that is, none of that's changed. Maybe the way you do it has changed, but, and it might be a little harder, you know,
yeah.
Like they say, yeah. If you teach on Zoom, the world is your potential, student base. That's great. Maybe it's not so great that those same people can evaluate taking lessons instead of with the younger new person. They can go to, you know, anyone.
Dave Weckl.
Yeah, right, right, right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. All right. Well, actually, that's a good point there. So, on the taking of online lessons, you teach online lessons. So you're obviously, if someone listening to this show wants to take a lesson with the great Joe Bergamini, how do they go about doing that?
So I have if you go onto my website, which you mentioned before, I just have a little link there that says you can message me, and there's one that actually says lessons. And I get those emails come right to my personal email, and I'm a little booked these days, but I always find ways to fit people. So
yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. No, and I think it's important, and obviously you're a very well-versed teacher who I think can get people, and you have a really nice setup. Folks listening on the podcast can't really see it, but you have a beautiful setup with multi-cam, you know, operation and all this stuff. So you're getting the highest quality experience from what I can tell.
I appreciate that. And I do, you know, in addition to the traditional weekly drum lesson thing, I do get asked a lot to do career consultations, or even just people who want to learn about the publishing business or all the other things I do. They'll book, you know, a session for an hour or two or a couple, you know, there's no needing to commit to like any kind of thing, you know, if somebody's listening to this and they're like, I want to play Broadway, I'll book a lesson with Joe, you know, that something like that requires me to, you know, I can't tell you if you have a chance until I know a lot about how you play.
Yeah,
sure. So that's not, you know, there's FYI, there's no secret. ain't no secret. It's hard work.
It's work. Yeah, it's work. That's the same thing with anything you're doing, is it's hard work. Yeah.
But thanks for mentioning that. I appreciate it, Bart.
Yeah, absolutely. And Joe, before we wrap up here, do you want to talk a little bit about the Sabian Education Network, which I know you're very involved in and proud of?
Thank you. A few years back, you know, after sort of getting known with all the educational things I do and having done a lot of clinics, and Sabian having supported me through all that for many years, they invited me. It's been, you know, sort of known, and I think maybe Sabian might have done some research to really show it clearly, that drum teachers have a huge influence, probably bigger than any endorser, on all the people they teach. And Sabian, being a company that supports education, wanted to create some kind of place for the teachers to come together and gather. And you know, they invited me to kind of try to design something for that. Yeah. And I kind of envisioned going to my first PASIC shows and meeting up with all these different drum teachers. You know, I had a couple of friends and they had a couple of friends. And next thing you know, we're in a bar having a beer in Nashville. And we're like, hey man, you know, what's your name? Oh, I'm Steve. I live in Seattle. Like, oh man, what do you use to teach beginner jazz? Well, I use it in the Chapin book. Oh yeah, but this kind of hard. What do you, you know, your checks, yeah. You know, my student canceled on short notice and I lost money. What did you, you know, oh, you got to have a policy, you know, like yeah. Talking about running a business, recruiting students, what books to use. And I wanted to replicate that. So we've been at it for a few years now. It's thousands strong. It's called the Sabian Education Network. If you teach drums, you're welcome to join. You don't have to, you should be a bona fide teacher, but if you only have one or two students, you fill out a little application. You can go to Sabian Ed. So it's Sabian, S-A-B-I-A-N Ed, like education, sabianed.com. Mm-hmm. And there's a little application and, you have access to like a forum and online resources, a members only website. And we do some live streaming that's public, but we've been doing a lot of private classes. Like yesterday, Dom Famularo and I did a class about using drum books and developing a curriculum. It was actually part three, but I've done classes for drum notation and finale. I've had David Garibaldi and other huge endorsers do private courses. So it's a, awesome. Yeah, it's kind of a club, for lack of a better word, for drum teachers. You don't have to be a Sabian artist or exclusive player to join. It's just there to kind of spread the love among teachers. So sabianed.com is the Sabian Education Network. I'm kind of the Pied Piper of it. So if you want to follow me over the cliff, come on and enjoy.
That's awesome. Joe, all right. So this has been awesome. And everyone listening, Joe is going to be kind enough to take a couple extra minutes after we wrap up the main episode and record a little Patreon bonus episode where we're going to talk about, you know, tips and tricks on being a working New York drummer, which I think, you know, we haven't done that yet, but I'm assuming those tips and tricks can apply to a drummer in Cincinnati or a drummer in, you know, wherever, Nashville, mm-hmm. a big city, a small city, anywhere. So Joe's going to do that. If you want to hear those episodes, you can go to drumhistorypodcast.com and click the Patreon link and $2 a month and up all the way up to the higher tier, like my friend, the great John DeChristopher, who's awesome and helped out. But Joe, thank you so much for doing this. It's an honor to meet you. And thanks again for being nice to 22-year-old me. And when I sent you a absolutely ridiculous email trying to make a book when I had no reason to do so. So, Joe, thank you for being here and taking the time to do this.
It's been my pleasure, Bart. And your younger self is welcome.
Thank you.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning.